Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. In this week's show, number 160, we present part two of the 2010 documentary known as Mountains of Waste, and also known as The Lightbulb Conspiracy. After that, we'll have edition two of the book report. Here I'll review Russ Baker's interesting book on American conspiracies and the Bush dynasty, titled Family of Secrets. That's coming up in about 20 minutes. But let's get back to the lightbulb conspiracy. This documentary is all about planned obsolescence. Last week we heard from a couple disciples of planned obsolescence, and we heard the stories of three products designed to fail early: the modern lightbulb, nylon hosiery, and the Apple iPod MP3 player. This week we'll hear about the Epson inkjet printer. This contains a chip designed to kill the printer after a certain number of copies. And yes, you can find a program online that reprograms the chip and restores your printer to life. But why should you have to? We'll hear from Ghana, which we are using as a dump for much of our used-up electronic waste. And we'll hear from scholars and activists who explain why we simply cannot continue producing, transporting, and dumping stuff the way we've been doing for the past 50 or 100 years. The lightbulb conspiracy was very ably adapted to radio by Robin Upton of www.unwelcomeguests.net and condensed and reorganized a bit by myself. And if you listen closely, you'll hear one of my own early attempts at radio acting. Yes, that is I, playing the English language voiceover of Barcelona shopkeeper number 3. But to return to modesty, here is part two of The Lightbulb Conspiracy.
This is Marcos from Barcelona, but he could be anyone, anywhere. What is about to happen to him occurs daily in offices and homes all over the world. A part inside the printer has failed, and the manufacturer sends Marcos to technical support.
Well, the technician can diagnose the problem, but it'll cost 15 euros plus VAT.
It's hard to get the parts for...
Realistically, it's not worth repairing.
Repair costs you about 110, 120 euro.
New printers start from 39 euros.
I recommend you buy a new printer.
It's best to buy a new one.
It's no coincidence that all three shopkeepers suggest buying a new printer. If he agrees, Marcos will become yet another victim of planned obsolescence, the secret mechanism at the heart of our consumer society.
Our role in life seems to be just to consume things with credit, to borrow money to buy things we don't need.
We live in a system based on a growth economy. We don't grow in order to satisfy needs. We grow in order to grow.
So if the consumer does not purchase, you know, the economy is not going to grow.
Planned obsolescence. The desire on the part of a consumer to own something a little newer, a little sooner than is necessary.
This film will reveal how planned obsolescence has defined our lives ever since the 1920s, when manufacturers started shortening the lives of products to increase consumer demand. In Barcelona, Marcos hasn't followed the advice of the shopkeepers to replace his printer. He's determined to repair it, and has found somebody on the internet who has discovered what has actually happened to his printer.
It's the dirty little secret of inkjet printers. I tried to print a document, and it said parts inside your printer require replacement, so I decided to do a little servicing of my own.
Hello, Marcos. I got your message.
Marcos has contacted the author of the video.
How are you? I looked into it, and it turns out that there's a thing in the bottom of the printer called a waste ink reservoir. And the way inkjet printers work is they constantly have to clean the print heads, and they do that by squirting ink through them down a hole in the bottom of the printer into this great big sponge. There's just a preset time when it's squirted a certain number of drops down there that then the printer decides it's full of ink and won't function anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The justification is they don't want to put ink all over your desk. But I think the problem goes deeper than that. It's the way the technology works. It's just designed to fail.
Planned obsolescence emerged at the same time as mass production and the consumer society.
The whole issue with products being made to last less long is part of a whole pattern that began in the Industrial Revolution, when the new machines were producing goods so much more cheaply, which was a great thing for consumers, but consumers couldn't keep up with the machines. There was so much production.
Looking at the service manuals of different printers, Marcos realizes that the lifespan of many printers is set by the engineers right from the start. They achieve this by placing a chip deep inside the printer.
I found the chip. It's an EEPROM, which counts the number of prints. When it reaches a set count, it shuts off the printer. The website address is visible, ssclg.com.
Marcos is on the internet again, looking for a way to extend the life of his printer.
ssclg.com.
He has discovered a Russian website which offers a free software for printers with a counter chip. The programmer has even gone to the trouble of explaining his personal motivation.
This happens due to bad construction. This is their business model, not a good one for user and environment. So I looked and found a way to make user-friendly software to allow active users a resident input counter.
Marcos doesn't know what to expect, but downloads the software anyway. Marcos is installing the Russian freeware on his computer. The new software allows him to reset the counter chip inside his printer back to zero. The printer immediately unblocks. Obsolescence produces a constant stream of waste, which is shipped to third world countries, such as Ghana in Africa.
It's been between 8 and 9 years now when I noticed that loads and loads of containers were coming to this country with electronic waste. We're talking about end-of-life computers, end-of-life television sets, which nobody wants in the developed countries.
Shipping electronic waste to third world countries is forbidden by international law, but the merchants use a simple trick. They declare the waste as second-hand goods. More than 80% of the electronic waste that arrives in Ghana is totally beyond repair, and whole container loads are abandoned at dump sites all around the country.
We are at the dump site here in Agbogbloshie. In the past, we had this beautiful river called the Odor River, you know, that meandered its way through this area. It was teeming in the past. It had so much fish. We actually attended a school not very far away from here. So we'd come play football and hang around the river. The fishermen would organize boat rides, I remember very well. But now it's all finished, it's all gone. And that makes me really, really sad. And it makes me angry.
These days, there are no school kids playing here after class. Instead, youngsters from poor families come here looking for scrap metal. They burn the plastic-covered cables from the discarded computers to salvage the metal inside. What is left is picked through by the younger children who are looking for any tiny pieces of metal which the older boys may have missed.
Behind the shipment have said that, well, we're trying to bridge the digital divide between Europe, America, and then the rest of Africa and Ghana, of course. But the reality is that these computers that are sent here simply do not work. There's no point in receiving electronic waste when you cannot deal with it, more so when you did not produce it and your country is being used as the world's trash bin.
The trash that for so long in the industrial age has been hidden from view is now coming into our lives and we can actually no longer easily avoid it. The waste economy is reaching its last legs because they don't physically have anywhere else to put the waste.
I think in the course of time, we've come to realize that the planet that we're living on cannot sustain that forever. There's a limit to natural resources and there's a limit to energy resources that we have.
Posterity will never forgive us. Posterity will suddenly find out about the throwaway attitudes, the throwaway lifestyles of people in the advanced countries.
People all over the world have started acting against planned obsolescence. Mike Anane is fighting against it from the receiving end. He has started by collecting information.
This is where I keep the e-waste that have asset tags or property tags. This says Amu Center Nordvest Zeeland. It's from Denmark. This is from Germany, sent here simply to be dumped. Westminster College. Apple should know better. It's a company that claims to be so green. There's a lot of Apple products that are being dumped here. I have a database that contain the asset tags, the contact addresses, telephone numbers of the companies that owned the electronic waste that have been dumped in Ghana.
Mike Anane plans to turn this information into evidence for a court case.
We need to take some action, some punitive measure. We need to sue people so they stop dumping e-waste in Ghana.
From a small village in France, John Thackera fights planned obsolescence by helping people share business and design ideas. Ideas which come from all over the globe.
In all poorer countries, things are repaired automatically. The notion you throw a product away just because it breaks for some reason is completely unknowable and unthinkable, actually, to somebody in the south. In India, there's an actual word, jugaad, to describe this tradition of being able to fix things pretty much regardless of the complexity of it. We try to find people who are actively doing projects in the world rather than just talking about things or making abstract statements about how awful things are or what has to be changed.
One of these people is Warner Phillips, descendant of the dynasty of light bulb manufacturers.
I remember my grandfather taking me to one of the Phillips factories in Eindhoven to show me how light bulbs were mass manufactured in factories, which is very, very cool.
Nearly 100 years after the creation of the light bulb cartel, Warner Phillips follows family tradition with a different approach. He produces an LED bulb which lasts 25 years.
It's not like there's a green world and there is a business world. I think business and sustainability go hand in hand. It's actually the best basis to build a business on. And the only real way to do that, I believe, is to factor in the true costs of the resources that have been used, but you also look at the energy consumption. You also look at the indirect energy consumption of transportation.
if transport has paid the real costs to the environment, say nothing of the costs of using up the non-renewable resources like oil, the costs of transport might go up by a factor of 20 or 30.
If you factor all of that in into every product that you manufacture, then there will be huge incentives for manufacturers and entrepreneurs all over the planet to make products that last forever.
Fighting against planned obsolescence can also be achieved by rethinking the engineering and production of consumer goods. A new concept called Cradle to Cradle claims that if factories worked like nature, planned obsolescence itself would become obsolete. Nature produces abundantly, but fallen blossoms, dead leaves, and other discarded materials are not waste. They become nutrients for other organisms. A cycle.
There is no waste in nature, just food.
Braungart believes that industry can imitate this virtuous cycle of nature. He proved that this is possible when he redesigned the production process of a Swiss textile company.
For example, take this material, which is used to cover sofas and chairs. The dyes used to make it so toxic that it cannot be discarded with ordinary household waste.
Braungart found that hundreds of highly toxic dyes and chemicals were routinely used at the factory. For the production of the new fabrics, Braungart and his team reduced the list to 36 substances, all biodegradable.
We choose only edible dyes. The goal is you should be able to cut it up into chunks and eat it on your breakfast cereal if you want to. In a disposable society, every short-lived product creates problems. But if we produce using biodegradable materials, every short-lived product is a chance to make something new.
For the more radical critics of planned obsolescence, reforming production is not enough. They want us to rethink our entire economic system and our values.
It's a real revolution which needs a cultural change. It's a paradigm shift, a change of thinking.
This revolution is called degrowth. Serge Latouche travels from conference to conference explaining how to get out of the growth society altogether.
Degrowth is a provocative slogan intended to break us out of the mindset which regards perpetual growth as possible and sustainable,
infini,
which clarifies the need to change our logic. The main message of the degrowth movement is reduction, reducing our burden on the environment, reducing despoilation, reducing overproction and overconsumption. By reducing time spent on making and consuming, we free up time so we can develop other forms of wealth which have gone unregarded, such as friendship, knowledge, and wisdom.
De ne pas s'épuiser quand on les consomme, comme l'amitié, le savoir.
We increasingly rely on objects to give us a sense of self-esteem and identity. Partly the consequence of the breakdown of things that used to give us identity, like membership of a community or relationship to the land or all sorts of soft and social things which have been replaced by consumerism.
Si le bonheur,
if our happiness depends on our level of consumption, we should be 100% happy. We're using 26 times as much as people did in the time of Marx. But all investigations show that people are not 20 times happier, because happiness is always subjective.
Critics of degrowth fear that it will destroy the modern economy and take us straight back to the Stone Age.
But to go back to a society with sustainable development, it's not to go back to the Stone Age, but to go back to the 1960s. That's a long way from the Stone Age.
Ça n'est pas vraiment l'âge de pierre. On peut dire que la
degrowth fulfills Gandhi's vision. The world is big enough for everybody's needs, but will never be big enough for everybody's greed.
And thus, a little unceremoniously, ends our adaptation of The Light Bulb Conspiracy. Well, let's see if we have the time for another book report, this time on Russ Baker's Family of Secrets. Fanfare, please. Russ Baker's book, Family of Secrets, is a very good work of investigative journalism. It's about the Bush dynasty and their baleful effect on democracy and on world affairs. It was published in 2009, a bit of bad timing for Baker. W. Bush's term as president had just ended, and the nation was thoroughly sick of him. And many Americans were expecting a big turnaround in affairs from new President Barack H. Obama. Many Americans were sadly mistaken, of course, and as I see it, we just suffered through 2 years of more of the same, with the same people calling the shots. So a book on the Bush dynasty and the forces it represents is a lot more relevant to 2011 than some might at first think. I first heard of the book from a speech Russ Baker gave, which was rebroadcast on the radio show 9/11 Wake Up Call, hosted by my friend and colleague at WWH, Cheryl. My local library snagged the book for me from another library in the region. It's close to 600 pages long, by the way, and it strikes me as either too long or too short. I'm not sure which. It covers maybe 80 years of American history and three generations of Bushes. Prescott, Poppy, which is to say George Herbert Walker, and George W. The index alone runs to 19 pages. Baker is a sharp, keen-eyed, and judicious investigative reporter, and his discussion of the real forces behind political events is very interesting indeed. The picture that keeps coming to mind is of a spider's web, as in a web of deceit or a web of intrigue. And the Bush players are always close to the center of the web, though never in the center. There's always a degree or two of separation, of deniability. One of the revelations here is that Poppy Bush was CIA for many decades, from the 1950s at least. When Reagan appointed this apparent non-entity to head the CIA, everyone was scratching his head in disbelief. Who was this inexperienced outsider? Turns out he had been a company man almost since the CIA's founding, and naval intelligence before that. All of the businesses the Bushes invested in, Zapata Oil, Harkin Energy, Arbusto Petroleum, they never made a cent for outside investors, and all seemed deeply involved in covert espionage overseas. Body of Secrets presents some additional evidence of the CIA's role in John F. Kennedy's assassination, including a role by Poppy Bush. Here's an instance in which I wish this 600-page book had been longer. It does not pretend to be a definitive history of the Kennedy assassination, but there's enough stuff to tantalize you. There's a good discussion of Lee Harvey Oswald, who appears to have been the CIA's tool and designated patsy in the assassination. In fact, Oswald's first words at his arrest were not, "Yeah, I shot the bastard," but rather, "I'm a patsy." And there's a good discussion of the enigmatic Russian emigre, George de Morenshield, an acquaintance of Poppy, who is apparently Oswald's CIA handler. Like many figures in the JFK assassination, de Morenschild died suddenly under mysterious circumstances. Like both of the two women who filed rape charges against George W. Well, one didn't officially die, she just sort of disappeared. The other officially committed suicide by shooting herself in the head, shortly after filing charges. Wait a minute, how many women kill themselves by shooting themselves in the head? I mean, isn't that sort of a guy thing? Never mind, the police and grand jury in Texas declared it a suicide. For me, the most fascinating part of the book is the story of how Poppy Bush helped do in his nominal boss, Richard M. Nixon. Poppy was head of the Republican National Committee at the time, Nixon's link to the Republican Party's rich donors. Turns out, a lot of the donors, including George H.W., thought Nixon was way too soft on the issue dearest to their hearts, preserving an amazing tax loophole known as the oil depletion allowance. Baker makes an amazing and very convincing case that the Watergate Hotel burglary, which proved to be Nixon's undoing, was done entirely without Nixon's knowledge for the sole purpose of framing Nixon. If not for the burglary itself, then for an alleged cover-up. The supposed knight on a white horse, Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, was ex-Naval Intelligence, and at least formerly CIA, as was Poppy Bush. And the Washington Post and its publishers had long-standing CIA links. Just coincidence, I guess. And of course, there are plenty of details on George W., though the details won't come as a surprise to the 1,500 or so of us who kept our eyes open during the past 10 years. But if you want to find the details of, say, W's going AWOL from the Texas Air National Guard, and the incredible resources devoted to covering up his dereliction of duty, you'll find them in this book. Family of Secrets is a first-rate work of investigative journalism. As I said, I think that, ideally, it should be either longer or shorter. As it stands, it's still well worth reading. On a scale of 1 to 5, I give this book a 4, which I consider a good grade indeed. Russ Baker, Family of Secrets, published 2009 by Bloomsbury Books. I urge you to borrow it from your public library, buy it, or, best of all, buy it for your public library. And thanks for listening to Edition 2 of The Book Report. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Robin Upton of Unwelcome Guests, www.unwelcomeguests.net. And if you are stuck with a self-destructing Epson inkjet printer, you can undestruct it with the free software described in this installment. Pencil handy? Go to www.ssclg.com/EpsonE. That's EPSONE.html. Once again, www.sclg.com/EPSONE.html. If you didn't quite catch that address, you'll find a link to it on our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Illegitimi non-carborundum, don't mourn, organize, and please come back again next week. Ciao.